welcome to Indiana Weekend with John Strauss. This is a kind of radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. We're always interested in your thoughts. Drop us a note to indianaweekend@gmail.com with your suggestions and comments. Let us know what's going on where you are. Ball State just held its 12th in-print Festival of First Books. It's a two-day event with writers who have just published their first books on campus to talk about their experiences, give readings, and work with students. Also on hand, an editor from a small press or literary journal to talk about getting published. This year's writers included poet Ileana Roca, fiction writer Sequoia Nagamatsu, and creative nonfiction writer Dan Rayburn. We talked with them via Skype before the conference. Rayburn is the author of Vessels, a memoir. He teaches nonfiction writing at the University of Chicago and says new writers can get a lot from these conferences.
For the students, their question is, how do I go from where I am right now to where you are? And where the distance between where they are and we are is not that great. In many cases, my guess is it would be somewhere between 6 to 10 years. So I think those kind of visits are really useful for young writers in a way that the big name kind of rock star writer who is sort of, when they come to town, there's sort of what we call the laying on of hands, you know, like Philip Roth comes and nobody gets to go out to eat with him and nobody gets to talk with him. And they're not very approachable because of their level of success. They're essentially almost insulated from the students in many cases. Not always, but sometimes. And I think first-time writers, first-time publishers are more willing to sort of, they're more able to remember what it's like to be that 21-year-old who's got this idea for a first novel or a work of nonfiction or a book of poems.
What do you wish you'd knew then that you know now?
I'm glad I didn't know how hard it was to finish a book, because I never would have done it. So I think my ignorance was an asset. I would not have, and also I'm glad I didn't know how little it paid, or else I wouldn't have done it. As far as what I wish I had known, I wish I had known that writing is essentially an end in itself. It is not necessarily a career. It's a labor of love. It is a career in that you dedicate your life to it, but it's an avocation, not a vocation. And I wish I had had fewer illusions about getting published, which is actually easier than you think. A lot of books are published. It's not ultimately as hard as you might think when you're young. I also wish I had known that it doesn't matter who you know or what your connections are. I think writing is essentially a meritocracy, with exceptions, of course, but by and large, editors only care about three things: your first sentence, your second sentence, and every sentence after that. That's really what gets you published, is your actual manuscript, not where you went to school, not who you know, things like that.
You must hear all the time people say, oh, I've got a book in me, you know, or...
Oh, yeah.
The difference between folks who say that and folks who do it, I guess, is sitting down in front of a blank screen and...
And doing it. A blank piece of paper for me. I still write in longhand. That's one reason why I'm so slow. Yeah, I do think that talent is overrated and persistence is underrated. Just to give you an example of me, in 1991, I was a senior, fourth year at the University of Iowa, undergraduate, English major, taking creative writing classes from the world-famous Iowa Writers' Workshop. Not the world-famous one, but a special section they created to humor undergraduates and essentially provide employment for a talented graduate student in the MFA program there. And I plugged away and I worked hard. And I would say out of the 12 of us in that writing class, I was probably number six in terms of talent. And I'm the one who went on to publish because I was more persistent, I think, than number one through five. And also often people just had better things to do with their lives. So, you know, one guy became a comedian, which is a very important job, especially in times like this. We need comedians more than ever. Another guy became a doctor. Another guy became a songwriter, you know, and he was the most talented writer of all of us, but he never wrote prose again. He never wrote stories again or memoirs or essays. He just wrote song lyrics. But I just kept plugging away at it for 10 years and managed to get published because I was so persistent. And that is the difference, because everybody thinks they have a book in them. It's true. People tell me this all the time. I've got a great idea for a book. I'll tell it to you and you write it down. It's a good way to get out of doing the work themselves, because it's hard, lonely work. It's not fun. It's nothing like it is in the movies. You know, in the movies, there's always the scene where the man or the woman sits down in front of the typewriter and lights up a Camel unfiltered cigarette and pours a glass of scotch and starts typing. And then it fades and you see the full ashtray and the empty whiskey bottle and 200 pages of manuscript stacked up next to the typewriter. Doesn't work that way.
What's your life like that people wouldn't expect? Is it an early morning thing? Is it a,
yeah.
Is there a ritual?
It's the early morning ritual. That's right. It's just like putting on your shoes and going out for a run or going to the yoga studio or whatever. You have to not think about it. You just have to do it and force yourself to show up every day, even when it's going bad, especially when it's going poorly. That's the most important time, to keep showing up every day. And I think of it as getting the bad days out of the way. You know, you're going to have 3, 4, 5 bad days before you have the breakthrough where you finally figure out, oh, right, this paragraph goes here and this 10 pages that I slaved on for a whole month, they get thrown away, or they get put in the probably not pile. Get them out of here. Don't even look at them. You know, and then you solve the big structural problems of that chapter, or sometimes the whole book, in a flash of insight. But you have to have many, many days of banging your head against the wall before that day comes.
People are told to write what they know. For yep. young folks, though, they may not have had much life experience.
Well, I think in my field, because I write nonfiction, I'm not a novelist. So write what you know, particularly if you're going to write an essay or a memoir, that is what you're writing. I mean, I believe everybody writes what they know, even if they make it up, even if they're making it up in their imagination, even if it's science fiction, they still know it insofar as it's in their head. So I tell my students, like, what happened isn't always that important. You don't have to have gone to Afghanistan and been in the Kandahar Valley in a firefight to write a piece about the war in Afghanistan. You know, you can write a good piece about the war just by reading about it. That's the magic of books. It allows us to get outside of our own little tiny skull-sized kingdom and experience other people's experience of the world. I also tell them, like, what happened means is more important often than what happened. What meaning you can make out of even relatively small everyday things. Like, for example, my book, Vessels, it's about having children and raising kids and becoming a dad and growing up, really not growing up until middle age, which I think is very common for people of my generation, Generation X. I think we postponed adulthood as long as humanly possible. And now we're embracing it, you know. We're all helicopter parents now. And I just want to say, again, like I tell my students that, if particularly in nonfiction, in essayistic nonfiction, what happened means is more important often than what happened. It doesn't have to be an adventure story or an action story. It can be the story of your thinking.
Dan Rayburn, who teaches nonfiction writing at the University of Chicago, speaking from his home in that city a few days before appearing recently at Ball State. He was part of the In Print Festival of First Books with advice and encouragement for young writers.
Lady waiter on the TV. Yeah, she had another quality.
Indiana Weekend, interesting people and places from across our region. Look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line. Let us know what you think at indianaweekend@gmail.com. Now here's John Strauss.
Ball State's English department just held its 12th annual In Print Festival of First Books. The 2-day conference features writers who've just published their own first books, offering encouragement to newer writers. The event also features an editor from a small press. This year's writers included poet Ileana Rocha, a Texas native who's an assistant professor of creative writing at the University of Central Oklahoma. Her first collection is called Karankawa.
So the Karankawa, the title, I get a lot of questions about that. The Karankawa were an Indian tribe in the region of Texas where all of my family are from. And the book is inspired by the passing of my aunt, and she kind of lived in the heart of where the Karankawa lived. And unfortunately, a lot of information about their tribe was lost. So, you know, when there's kind of these omissions in narratives, you know, we kind of have an impulse to kind of insert our own stories in there. So that's kind of what happened with the Karankawa Indians. So I kind of used that logic or that line of thinking and applied it to my own family narratives. You know, what things have we left out? You know, how do we fill in those empty gaps in our history? So that's kind of how I saw the parallel between the Karankawa Indians and my own family.
What was it like getting this project published?
When you're in a PhD program and you're kind of working on all these like intangible projects and, you know, you kind of never think they're going to see the light of day. So, you know, when I got the call that I won the award and that Joy Harjo had chosen my collection, and I'm such a fan of hers, I always have been, and for her to kind of choose the collection and to see, you know, a spirit in the collection that resonated with her. And I mean, I can only classify it as being planetary, and there's no other way to explain it. It's out of this world.
Do you remember kind of being in the place where some of these attendees are, you know, they are wanting to get published, they're eager to hear from folks like you? Can you remember what that was like?
The process to me is just so nebulous, and it's kind of hard to put my finger on the point of even being able to understand, you know, what this is like. And I've been lucky enough to have my book like taught in some classes, and to see, I just visited a class, you know, last week, and to see everybody kind of have my book in their hands was really, it was surreal. Because you never know, you know, who you're going to reach and, you know, what they're going to take away from your writing. And I think to have that kind of reach is, I mean, I still can't really put my finger on that feeling.
Well, I don't think that we understand poetry too well, just in general, the public.
Right.
How do you talk to people about it?
I mean, this is something I run into a lot because I teach, you know, creative writing classes and I teach poetry classes. And I think people, you know, they think if they just put some lines down on a page, you know, they're a poet. And in one sense, that's true. But in another sense, there's such a level of craft that I think, you know, you learn and you read other poets who've come before you and you imitate, you model, you revise, and you add to the tradition, kind of like T.S. Eliot talked about. So on one hand, I really appreciate that spirit. And, you know, not everybody's coming to poetry in herds and in droves. So when a student shows even the slightest bit of interest, I'm just like, come to me and never leave. And, you know, one of my my great mentors, Bill Olson, said, you know, that people's enthusiasm for poetry is so fragile that we have to do everything we can to nurture it. So I take that to heart. So even if they need to know a little bit about craft, I'm happy to talk to them about it as long as the spirit and the enthusiasm is there. That's the first step.
How do you help people grow as a poet?
I tell them to read because I think a lot of times they don't read poetry. They don't know. I mean, the only kind of confrontation they've had with poetry has been like Shakespeare. And, you know, for a lot of people, that's not the first thing that they readily connect with. So I try to show them contemporary poets that I think will kind of meet their aesthetic halfway. And I've seen a lot of people transform from reading like what's new out in the field. And from there, the kind of transformation takes place. And you see them, you know, identify with like Natalie Diaz or Eduardo Corral and, you know, Danez Smith and these wonderful kind of urgent writers contributing right now. And they latch onto that because they see that poetry has contemporary relevance. And I think that part is missing in the pedagogy in a lot of poetry classes and literature classes, that poetry has immediate and contemporary relevance, especially, you know, during this time.
Everyone's different, but what do you like to see people working on? What do you think is especially helpful for people trying to develop this?
Developing a personal voice, taking risks, kind of moving beyond like the tropes that we've seen, you know, kind of blurring the boundaries between, you know, poetry and prose. I'm really interested in genre right now. And I've had a friend tell me once, you know, you should write poetry that gets you arrested. So I'm into the rebellion aspect of it. And I want to see people do things that, you know, I haven't seen before.
By the way, can I just say that Taylor Molly, I kind of like this guy. He did does this spoken word stuff and did something called Tony Steinberg, Seventh Grade Viking Warrior. I know this guy because he's on YouTube, but I feel as if I've seen him because I have seen him perform.
Yeah.
What do you think about this as a means of reaching audiences, this technology that we have and everything?
Yeah, and I think there is a divide between kind of slam or more performative poetry and academia. But there are writers like Danez Smith, who I mentioned, who kind of started off more in the performative and who have really bridged the gap between those two kind of divides. So, I mean, poetry is changing. This is such a great time, you know, because of all of the digital access that people have now and on the all the online journals that are kind of, you know, working away the mainstream and publishing things that perhaps mainstream publications wouldn't. Just, you know, people taking risks and people having more opportunity and access.
You've mentioned taking risks a couple of times, and,
yeah.
and I think you made a reference to, you know, you should write something you can get arrested for or something
yeah.
like that. I mean, do you have something from Karankawa maybe that you like as an example of something where you took a risk and
sure.
you've seen it pay off?
Yeah. One of my favorite poems in the collection is Self-Portrait with Headphones On. And, you know, I get questions about this poem all the time because it references Kanye West and it references like rap and hip hop and kind of that imagery. And, you know, people are like, wow, you know, why do you kind of reference these pop culture icons? And, you know, I don't really see a lot of people doing that. And my answer always is like, you know, my mythology is not like Zeus and Athena. Like, those are great figures, but they're not mine. You know, my mythology is my family mythos and my pop culture icons. I am really into drag and drag queens. Like, those are my mythological figures that I reference and that I allude to because that's part of my personal landscape. So I think I include a lot of pop culture references in my collection, and maybe it's to someone that's risky.
Poet Ileana Rocha, one of the writers at this year's In-Print Festival of First Books. Her work draws from such sources as popular culture, rap music, and Mexican folklore, part of her own cultural heritage.
And he said some got pencils and some got guns. Some know how to stand and some of them run. We don't get along, but we sing the same song. Party for the fight to write, we'll write on. Stay gold, pony boy. Stay true, outspoken. Make a record, Mr. Gangster, and get them all.
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss on Indiana Public Radio.
Ball State's In-Print Festival of First Books is worth checking out each spring. The two-day festival features writers who've just published their first books. They come to talk about their experiences, give readings, and work with students. Also on hand, an editor from a small press to talk about getting published. This year's writers included fiction writer Sequoia Nagamatsu, assistant professor of creative writing at St. Olaf College in Minnesota. He's author of the story collection Where We Go When All We Were Is Gone. And like every writer, learned a lot from the publication of his first book.
I think one thing that I didn't really expect is that by the time that I was actually able to open the box of my sort of contributor copies, or I guess sort of like my author copies that I got from the publisher, it was already maybe about a year out after I had actually sent the manuscript, and probably more like 2 years out after I had actually completed the manuscript itself. So I think before I had a book published, for me, I thought I would be jumping up and down and super excited. And don't get me wrong, I was super excited. Blackburn Press did a beautiful job with the book, and I'm more than happy to go out there and read from it and talk to people about my process and share my stories. But in many ways, I was a very different writer by the time I was able to hold the book, and I was already working on these other projects. So that was something that was, I think, that I didn't really predict prior to having a first book.
Can you talk about your first book?
So a lot of the material, press material about it, sort of toots it as being inspired by Japanese folklore and pop culture. And that's, you know, by and large true. Most of the stories are, I would say, could be classified as fabulist or magical realist. So it certainly infuses fantasy in everyday situations. most of the stories are formally experimental in some way, and those are some of kind of just my aesthetic leanings. I didn't initially plan to write a collection that was sort of inspired by Japanese folklore. That sort of, I think, happened by accident. I was living in Japan in sort of the mid-2000s for a couple of years. And so I think that was like a really formative experience for me, not just only in terms of this book, but also in terms of my life as a writer generally. I think prior to living in Japan, I was more of a hobbyist writer. I met writing groups, met with writing groups. I wrote from time to time, but I never really considered going for my MFA. I never really considered becoming a creative writing professor. I didn't think it was something that was possible. I didn't think I was good enough. But there is something to be said about being, I think, linguistically and culturally isolated to a degree when I was living in Japan. So it allowed me a lot of free time to sort of sit in my apartment. You know, when I got tired of watching Japanese variety shows and actually kind of just pounding away some stories on the computer, forming an online community with other writers to improve that work. And so some of the older stories from the collection kind of came from that time. And by the time I got back to the States and was in my MFA program, I had maybe amassed maybe four or five of these stories that were loosely about, you know, set in Japan. They were all vaguely fantastical. And I think sort of my first year of grad school, I decided that this was maybe something that could be a book. So I decided to write more of those stories.
Fiction writer Sequoia Nagamatsu, one of the writers who appeared this week at the Ball State English Department's In Print Festival of First Books. We also heard from poet Ileana Rocha and creative nonfiction writer Dan Rayburn, talking with them before the conference. Different forms, fiction, nonfiction, and poetry, but good advice from these first-time authors for others seeking to find a publishing home. The best advice from these writers, if you could sum it up, would seem to be keep going, find a good program, and especially find your own voice. And that's our show for today. I'm John Strauss. Big thanks to our producer, Sean Ashcraft, and the folks in the front office, including your friends Matt Bloom, Connie Clary, Lori Georgie, Emily Kowalski, Andrea Lutz, John Morgan, Angie Rapp, Debbie Webb, Alicia Franklin, and Elena McKenzie. In the meantime, thanks and have a great week until we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend on Indiana Public Radio.
Indiana Weekend with host John Strauss. Our show is engineered at Indiana Public Radio, produced by Sean Ashcraft. Major support for Indiana Weekend comes from IPR's listeners. We hope you'll join your friends who are IPR members. You can go to indianapublicradio.org or give us a call at 1-800-646-1812. Join us again next week for Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.